When you go beyond that, or when you cross that border of an ethical line, just make sure that either you do it intentionally, or you've got someone saying, but hey, you've crossed that, and why are you crossing it?
Welcome to the Church Digital Podcast. Through this podcast, we'll talk about the technological innovations within the church. But more than tech for tech itself, we'll address deeper questions. Is disciple-making possible digitally? How should we approach the digital mission field? Can a biblically grounded church operate in digital space? Oh, and where does the metaverse and artificial intelligence fit into all of this? Whether you're a big or small church, the Church Digital's goal is to help churches like yours learn to be a multiplying church, digitally and physically. And now here's your host, Jeff Reed.
Episode 285 of the Church Digital Podcast. Jeff here, founder of the Church Digital. Love having this conversation with you. Glad you all are here. Oh, I forgot my best part. The Church Digital Podcast, powered by Riverside. How could I forget Riverside up here at the top? Hey, we're talking artificial intelligence. We'll have Quentin McGrath coming up here in a little bit, talking about ethics of AI, and it's going to be a great conversation. But Riverside, oh my gosh. Every time I turn around, I don't know that this is true, but literally every time I log on to the Riverside platform to do some work here on the Church Digital Podcast, I feel like they're rolling out some new feature. Or maybe I'm just discovering it now as I'm digging into it more at a personal level. But oh my gosh, between the clips that it's generating, the social snapshots, the transcripts, the takeaways, the topics, chapters now, artificial intelligence is so baked into this Riverside platform, and it is so helpful into what I'm trying to do and what people like you, churches like you, are trying to do with your podcasts. Oh my goodness, and your YouTube videos. You need to be checking out Riverside. Do me a favor right now, thechurch.digital/Riverside. Pause this. Come back to Quentin McGrath and AI ethics of Sora. We'll get there. Pause it, open up a new window, pull over the car, take out your phone, open up the web browser, thechurch.digital/Riverside. Check out that website and learn more about how Riverside can help your church do incredible stuff with video. Okay, so let's get into this podcast. Now, you've already done that. You paused the video. You came back in. We're going to talk now about this on the podcast and the video, talking about the ethics surrounding text-to-video and Sora. So, OpenAI, the inventors of ChatGPT, and the people that made all this noise going back October 22, November 22 and beyond, hey, guess what? They're rolling out this new technology. It's only getting to certain people, but this new technology isn't just text. It's not even just text to photo. It's now text to video, where now we can create minute long video clips, simply based off of text. And things like deepfakes are suddenly becoming much more of a reality. What are the ethics surrounding this? As a church, do we like this idea, or are we petrified? I'll be honest, I'm terrified at this up front. And so I need to relax a little bit. But hey, let me at least be the guy to ask some questions. And so who am I going to talk to about that? I'm bringing in my friend Quentin McGrath. Quentin is he's got an interesting career in corporate. But it's also done a lot of studies recently involving artificial intelligence and ethics and risk assessment, risk management. So if I want to talk, and he also works with micro churches in the Tampa Bay, Florida area. And so if I want to talk with a guy about ethics of artificial intelligence and get a church perspective, well, Quentin's the guy I want to talk to. And so I re-emailed Quentin recently. I was like, hey, let's jump on. Let's talk about Sora, this new technology that OpenAI released or is releasing, and how we, the church, should be thinking about this. And so here's the conversation. And I got to tell you, I'm a little surprised walking away from this Quentin's take. But hey, let me introduce to you Quentin. And really, the conversation that I'm calling here, Sora, the ethics of Sora and text to video AI. Okay, everybody, here you go.
Well, thanks, Jeff, and great to be with you again. This is just fantastic. A bit of background on myself. So I was with Deloitte for many years, 24 years. Actually, I hate to admit that. 24 years I was with Deloitte as an organization. In fact, I was involved in a number of other organizations in South Africa before that. So that was a large part of my career. I was lucky to be able to retire from them in January 22. while I was actually busy with my doctoral studies. So I spent a couple of years of my doctoral studies focused on AI ethics and risk management. In that context, really understanding how we can apply AI in the world. And you can imagine now over the last 2 years, I was blessed with the opportunity of really understanding that and finding that and being guided to that at the time, because it really has changed and it's become such a fundamental thing in businesses, in fact, in all walks of life, in churches, in academia, just in how do we think about AI, how do we think about ethics, and how do we think about risks. And so what I'm doing the last 2 years or so, I've really moved into kind of the give back part of my career. And I'm involved a lot in mentoring. I'm involved as an adjunct professor at the University of South Florida, where I got my doctorate. And I'm also involved on a number of advisory councils and boards, really trying to figure out how do we put together AI, generative AI specifically in business, and how do we take advantage of it. And then very recently, I joined the AI and Faith as a research fellow. And so I'm working with that group as well, which is it's a group that is not only Christian faith, but literally all faiths and AI and the impact of all faiths, AI and all faiths. And so that's become a fun little exercise as well to understand just the thinking of the spirituality of what we're doing in this space.
That's beautiful. And so you can imagine, audience, like if I wanted to get into a conversation surrounding ethics of artificial intelligence and Sora and text to video and some of that, my gosh, like Quentin is an incredible voice in that. And you know, we even doing studies in background with Deloitte. And so I'm really looking forward to this. So, hey, let's do this. Let's just dive in. So we're talking about Sora. Well, I tell you, why don't we do this? Like, just maybe set up, because I don't know that I fully understand this. So, you know, text to video, Sora, I believe OpenAI is releasing this or has released this in limited capacity now. Like, what are we talking about here as we're talking about Sora or text to video?
Yeah. You know, and a lot of times when I heard text to video, it was like, haven't got this type of thing already? Haven't we got a number of situations? And in fact, I for a long time have a whole string of text, and I said, right, put a video on it and create a video. And so, you know, most people said, oh, we've had text to video for a long time, but this is different. This is really different. Because essentially what OpenAI have done is they've taken the same approach to prompting and said, right, now use that prompt. We used to create pictures, we used to create text, we used to get it to answer things. Now literally has taken the same approach and converted it into an up to 1 minute video clip. Now the video clip is rich, it's high quality. You can guide it to really be a very rich environment. You can kind of set the environment as you would use in the prompt in any other place. So, you know, one of the ones that we often see kind of on the front page of OpenAI's announcement is a Japanese scene, and there's a Japanese woman walking down in a wet street, you know, evening setting, lights reflection of the street, and literally walking down the street in a very natural and no jittering, no stopping, literally a whole smooth, excuse me, AI.
Nice. So, thank you very much, Siri. That was beautiful. Apple's not, their technology's not quite up to par yet.
Not up to par. So literally what you've seen this woman walk down the street in Japan, in the evening in Japan, seen the reflection and her natural moves, and eventually it comes and she looks directly into where the camera would be, but there's no camera, there's no reflection on the glasses. She's wearing glasses. And it's just the whole cycle, it's so smooth. And then they got a whole lot of other examples of just a literal prompt, a couple of sentences of prompt to creating these magnificent videos, literally of short videos that can be used. There's no sound associated with them at this stage, but you can see the richness of the environment. And literally, if you go to OpenAI/Sora, and you can see all the examples that they've put up there. And I'm really excited about it because I think it gives a whole lot of creativity openings. Just like we've had in terms of, hey, I want to create something, I don't want to start with a blank sheet of paper, but this whole process of actually getting something in place and setting it up and moving forward with a lot of really high quality results right from the start.
Have you, because I this is technically this is released at this point technology, right? But they're only releasing it to certain people as they're kind of testing it out. Like, what's the current status of it?
The current status, as you can understand, is they released it. So there was a blog post, which is what they normally do. OpenAI normally does everything new they release out in a blog post. And in that blog post, they said they are releasing it to the red teaming. And the intention of releasing it to the red teaming is because you can imagine this is so, so complex to begin testing. They are then releasing it to a small group of people who are going to go through the process of putting guardrails in place. So just like with large language models, you have the big training of the data, and then you have to put some type of guardrails. I call it making the child polite, essentially. You know, putting those guardrails in place to make sure that they then say the right things or don't say the wrong things. And so that is the process that they're looking at this stage. It's going to be a complex process because it's very hard to figure out what's going to be prompted and how it's going to be prompted. And clearly there are going to be levels of misuse of this. But they're trying to put guardrails in place as they have been doing. And OpenAI has been trying to do that progressively with all their releases. So that's where they are at this stage. And how long it's going to be in red teaming, they haven't announced. And I presume their normal style is to open it to a closed group of people and then progressively open it beyond that. But what they have shown at this stage is very, very interesting.
So, I mean, let's get in here a little bit. The idea of text to video, I can create a 1 minute video clip of a very detailed Japanese woman, walking on the street in rain, like artistically, creatively. That's beautiful. It's interesting story. My son's 13 and he's actually starting to study videography in school. And so he was creating his first clip of video the other day. And I don't understand why this is what he chose, but he was responsible for creating a 3 minute video clip of raining hot dogs, where literally like hot dogs were falling from the sky. And so it was just a bunch of video clips that he actually created. And we used not Sora because we don't have access to it, but we used other AI to kind of insert raining hot dogs. And once again, like he's a middle schooler, so I don't understand why. But Sora for him would be incredible because I'm sure Sora could make hot dogs rain from the sky. 13-year-old boys, whatever. Moving past that, like even past the creatives, like ethically, what concerns are we seeing with this idea of text to video? Like, to me, it seems like this might be a win, but it also could be a loss. Like, what's the negative as we're looking at this?
Yeah, so my context and ethics is always the two sides of the coin. So I do believe that there's an important part of ethics that we often don't look at is the good side. So the human flourishing element. And I love to think of it in context of shalom. So literally everything that goes with shalom and the wholeness is one of the critical parts of ethics. And then the other part, as you say, is not doing bad stuff and making sure we don't do bad stuff. So I think if we take a look at from a holistic perspective, the opportunities for good are definitely there, whether it's just being creative or just helping people. In fact, interestingly, on the website, OpenAI site, they start, their first sentence says, and let me quote it to you, "We are teaching AI to understand and simulate the physical world in motion with the goal of training models to help people solve problems that require real world interaction." So they're really saying the aim of this thing is to create an environment so you can understand and you can understand the real world interaction more effectively. So that's on the positive side. But I think if you then start saying, right, now what else opens up? And if I was trying to do bad things, what could I do? And you can imagine this whole space of when you add visual images, the ability to influence people just steps up. So we know just out of experience that if we look at something, we can keep a critical thinking, apply critical thinking to something, but over time, if we look at something and we get used to something, we get comfortable with that image. And so we start losing our critical thinking. And so the ability over time for the system or people to use it to create, you know, beautiful images or peaceful images, but at the same time then lean towards nudging someone to go to some place that they wouldn't normally go. And essentially through the beauty and through the imagery that's been put in, being able to soften a person's resistance to thinking about it in detail. So my big worries are the ability to to use the visual images to essentially reduce the critical thinking and reduce our logical mind, kind of shifting from left brain logical mind to right brain, which is much more able to accept things without judging them quite so harshly. So that to me is the one big element. The other part, of course, is you've got your fundamental biases that are built into training data. You know, as much as we love to think about it, we might think we're totally unbiased. We're all biased. And so the data that's been used to train has got some implicit biases in it. And we know that those biases are in the training data. And a lot of the guardrails that are put around that these large tech companies put in place try and take out some biases and in some ways also add some additional biases based on their own decisions in terms of what is ethical and what is normal. And so we got this whole situation where the training data has got some biases in it. And so we may get results coming out that are biased. Now, whether those are boldly biased and visibly biased, like saying all doctors are men, and clearly that's incorrect. Being able to then say, right, are there maybe even deeper biases which are less obvious that are going to start pushing us in one or other way? So that whole thing about bias and what's underlying in terms of the bias certainly does worry me. And then just kind of the deeper things where you start looking at deep fakes and people starting to think that this is real. We really have a problem because the quality of things, you know, I'm thinking about gaming even, the quality of the visuals and the sound and the environment is becoming so real that as humans, it's become harder and harder for us to say, this is real and this is not real. And so the ability, this is now even bring it even closer because the quality is so good that we start to say, oh, that must be real or that could be real or isn't that real? You know, and you can see very quickly the steps that we move towards saying, oh, that has to be real versus otherwise. And so I think those to me are probably the biggest worries. It's the bias, it's the ability to deepfake, it's the ability to actually shift us and nudge us in a direction that we don't really want to go. And bringing down all the barriers that we'd normally apply from a logic perspective.
Now, I know at some level, like there's a maybe filter is the right word. Maybe it's actually another stage of bias. But like there is in ChatGPT currently, like there is some level of filter. And when I filter, you know, I mean, like I've asked ChatGPT, you know, what's the best religion? I've talked about this in the podcast before. Like there are four religions. You know, what religion is right? I think that's actually, and it gave me a very filtered kind of everything is right, and it defined the Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, maybe I don't forget what the fourth was, but it defined it and it said the strengths of all four and it said that they were all right. And so like and just I got bored one day and decided to ask a whole bunch of stuff of Jasper and ChatGPT and couldn't get anything. And so somewhere in the nebulous sphere somebody coded that kind of filter or bias to, hey, you know, do that. Is it possible to filter, or will they be filtering this to, like, I mean, on the deepfake side, I mean, I'm thinking, hey, let's put the president of the United States in a brothel. I'm thinking, hey, let's create the next Scarlet Widow Marvel movie that without permission, you know, they just opened up Mickey Mouse where he's now public domain. And so Steamboat Willie, you can do like there's all of a sudden we've got this immense potential to do something that arguably, like if we're talking the betterment of mankind, this isn't the betterment of mankind. This is actually violating, you know, ethical principles, moral principles, business principles. Like this power is way beyond what I feel like almost, you know, my 13-year-old son should have access to.
Yeah. And I think you're right. And that it goes to that whole bias and consent side of things. Maybe rights and consent is probably a better way of putting it. So what do I have rights to do? And I, in this space, I always encourage people to say, not what can I do, but what should I do? And part of what we need to be saying is, what is our ethical framework that we're going to use to say, even though I can do this, I will not do it, or I should not do it, because I've got certain framings. Now, some of those are built in terms of guardrails. And yes, I've got no doubt that OpenAI is building in to make sure that there are certain things that are just not displayed, certain things that would be R-rated, for instance, and making sure I presume that they're going to be putting guardrails in to make sure that, that's not displayed. But I think there are certain things that even so we need to be saying in our own personal lives, in our own business lives, in our own spiritual lives, what things do we say is within a frame that we're comfortable with? And one of the things I was actually chatting to someone the other day, they're doing some AI work and, you know, helping people just from a dying perspective and really helping people process death. And they were just saying, right, they will not go past this point. And I was encouraging them to say, right, make sure you're writing that down and have a group of people around you, if you wish, your personal board of directors, who are going to continually hold you responsible for that. And when you go beyond that, or when you cross that border of an ethical line, just make sure that either you do it intentionally, or you've got someone saying, but hey, you've crossed that, and why are you crossing that? And so I really think it's important for us to say, I'm not going to rely on someone else to put the boundaries in place. I'm going to hold to certain ethical frameworks and ethical stances or positions based on what I believe is important. Now, my personal belief system is Judeo-Christian basis. And so I've got certain ethics based on the Bible that I'll use as a foundation to say, right, this crosses the line, or no, I will not go there, or this is good and yes, we should go there. Or if we go there, we can actually get some advantage. So let's be careful, but we'll not go further than that. And so the whole ability for us to be very, very careful and very clear on this is the line we are drawing. And so that might be in terms of visual images, just know how close are you going to go to, you know, beauty, and what is beautiful, and you know, at what point do you stop and say, oh, that's no longer, you know, honoring of God or honoring of the individual. And so being very careful on how we look at things. And then the other side, of course, is also when I'm looking at creating something, am I actually trying to convince someone to go a particular way? And I always remember C.S. Lewis, that he used his humor, he used his children's stories as a way of in some ways sliding in the gospel underneath in a children's story. And I think in some ways when we do that, we've got to be intentional about it and say, right, yes, I am doing that. And then that's for a reason. And then we need to be transparent about why we do it and how we're doing it. So I'm a Christian. I'm using this as a way of displaying my Christian faith. And here's an example. You know, and just being absolutely transparent about that, rather than just trying to get it out there and hope people will be moved in that direction, almost in an underhand, nefarious type of way. So part of it is how do we think about, and how do we make sure that we ourselves are not taking advantage of the nudging, even if we believe it is for what we believe a good purpose, without being transparent about that.
I mean, really, you're suggesting there's two different checks. One, we got to check ourselves in place to make sure that we the users of the tool are using it with ethical considerations. And so, you know, 13-year-old son, check, you know, at least I keep him in check, hopefully, as a parent. But the second piece is like, do we trust the people that are drawing the lines? And so, you know, OpenAI is a great example. You know, I trust OpenAI. You know, Google, literally, like, their motto is do no harm. And so, okay, maybe I trust Google. Maybe I trust Apple, although Siri is horrible. But there's always this other organization that we don't know about, or the international company that's weaponizing this. And yeah, weaponizing text to video. Yes, weaponizing text to video. Like, who else is a player in this space? Or are they all just cloning what Sora is and manipulating it for their own? Like, is there one organization that's really drawing the lines, or are we worried about other people? Am I just like paranoid? Like, who's actually drawing these lines?
All organizations are drawing their own lines. So let's be really honest with that. And I, as you say, some we've got to trust, or we've got used to trusting, maybe a better way of putting it. But even then, I recently did a research, and I, in fact, recently published a paper on this whole thing of what is embedded in terms of the ethical frameworks or the ethical positions within the large language models. And I found that, you know, one of the large language models was focused much more on a situationalist type of approach. And it was basically saying that I'm not going to hold to any firm truth. I'll be able to, based on the situation, I might change. Another large language model was based on absolutist model, so it's always going down this particular path. And so those are, even in what I would call the large, the big tech, the ones that we trust, there's already biases that are built in terms of how they've actually structured. And then if you go to the essentially the open source and the large language models and those that are beyond what we call the big tech, yes, there's the ability to then either train it with bad data, with in some cases poisoned data, and in other cases just do it intentionally because you're trying to drive a particular behavior, you're trying to drive a particular stance. And so part of what we've got to be looking at is understanding and have critical thinking around what is coming out and test and validate that we're comfortable with what is coming out of the AI in terms of its output. Now, be that video output or be that textual output or images, whatever it is. And so that's the important part, is to have that critical thinking. Now, when you start looking at this type of capability, so the Sora type capability, the amount of training that went in to make this model is very, very expensive and very it's expensive from a load perspective, and therefore the cost of electricity, the cost of processors, the cost of the environment to actually make it happen. And so to be able to do this, you have to be a very big organization with lots and lots of money. And we see Altman and others going around the world talking about the amount of dollars they need to actually move this forward. The amount of processors, GPUs that they need to actually make sure that they can train the models. So I think that in some ways, when you look at the power of these types of things, it is only the bigger ones that are really able to do it. Now, yes, over time we get efficiency in models, and it comes down the loading on the training and on the use comes down in terms of the power requirements. But at this stage, this type of capability in this high level of quality is really within the grasp of a very small number of organizations, a handful of organizations in the US, but also around the world, including the Far East and others. And so the whole process of who's going to be looking at it and how they're going to be using it is going to be important.
You know, I know obviously there's tons of privacy concerns as we're getting into this. Now, it's interesting. I Jeff Reed, I actually have ChatGPT'd my name and Jasper, like, and Jeff Reed as a name. You know, there's been a Jeff Reed that kicked a game-winning Super Bowl, kicked a field goal game-winning Super Bowl for the Steelers. I've won several World Series for the Cincinnati Reds, or at least another Jeff Reed has. I'm actually in jail for doing something with kids that you're not supposed to do with kids. That's another Jeff Reed. So if you've Googled Jeff Reed, like, there's lots of Jeff Reed's out there. And so, you know, I go into AI and, you know, ChatGPT, and I'm like, tell me a story about Jeff Reed, or who's Jeff Reed. And it doesn't have a clue who I am. But, you know, friends of mine, even in the digital space, Nils Smith, who's another Christian technologist, he, you know, knows who it is. Jay Kranda, digital pastor over at Saddleback. You know, Quentin McGrath is such a unique name. ChatGPT probably knows who you are better than it would me, because Jeff's reads more common. And so, like, it would seem to me, I could do a text to video. Sorry, Nils, I'm going to pick on you. I could do a text to video where I'm like, hey, give me a video of Nils Smith and putting him in a weird situation. And a deep fake involving Nils, like, would be very easy to reproduce because ChatGPT would know who Nils has. Like, am I reading? I'm sorry, OpenAI, Sora. Like, am I reading too much into deep fake? Like, is there going to be a permissions level? Should there be a permissions level? What are we looking at here when trying to prevent maybe some personal violations?
So one of the things that they have said is they're going to be building into the metadata, what they call the C2PA, which is a coalition for content provenance and authentication, so authenticity rather. So the C2PA metadata, that really says, just like images that you'll take on cameras, it'll actually say this is taken by a Canon with this lens, with this ISO rating, etc. And all that information is stored in the metadata of that actual content. And so what OpenAI is saying, they're going to be putting that information, they can be building that information into the data that's carried along in the video itself. And so you'd then be able to say, literally from here onwards, essentially, if I look at a video, I will be able to go back and say, hang on, but that's created by Sora. So that's what they've committed to. Now, are there going to be people who are going to be trying to jailbreak it? Yes. And are they going to be able to jailbreak it? I'm sure they will at some stage with the right amount of power and the right amount of thinking. But that at least gives us the foundation that we're starting to say, right, built in from design day, they're saying we're going to be putting these C2PA controls or metadata into that information, which immediately is going to help it. And by the way, they've also said it in their DALL-E imaging and others, they're going to be going back and doing the same types of things. And this is part of what we're going to have to build in, and it's more of an agreeing to build in. Because clearly, if I've got an open source model, I can choose not to do that. But really, the whole process of transparency and saying it's okay to say you used an AI, it's accepted, and in fact, it's expected that you're going to use AI in some other form. We all do, you know, whether that's Grammarly helping us write an email, you know, or getting some ideas from ChatGPT. All of that, all of us are starting to use it, and just the transparency around, of course, I'm using AI as a mechanism, and then having some type of marks in all of these things to say, right, this is not a human photograph, but actually it's an image that's been created by, you know, the latest version of image creation, AI image creation. And so that being built in, I think, is going to be really important. And there is some level of agreement that that's going to be built in. And then over time, more and more, we're going to find the signatures within these various capabilities are going to be starting to look similar, and so being able to see that there is, you know, this is AI generated, it's too precise, etc. And so those types of things, I think we're going to start seeing being built in naturally.
I love that idea of, you know, as a content creator, you know, some of the stuff that I use is well, I mean, everything that I write is, I very rarely use AI at this point for writing, because I'm usually thought leadership ahead of AI, honestly, and like it hasn't caught up to the craziness that I'm talking about. But like in photos and things, like I love Adobe Stock. It declares what's AI and what's not. Like, and I've seen that on other services. It's interesting, like even that declaration. Man, I forget what state, but I was just reading about this, where there are states that are now, maybe it was the state, maybe it was a nation, but talking about like automated driving, like the Teslas. There's conversation now about there being a blue light above the brake lights on the back of cars, and so when a car is being, you know, self-driven or driven by AI or machine or whatever you want to call it, like that blue light comes on. And so whoever is behind knows, hey, that car is being driven by a machine. And so the driver knows, okay, let me get in the other lane because I don't trust it. Let me hurry up and get around it. Or I'm completely comfortable with that information and can, you know, it can treat it accordingly. And so, you know, even as a content creator, being able to know, okay, this is machine generated, this is not, like I'm the ability for me to use those tools accordingly, like I love that. And so that's interesting. I mean, there's still probably some challenges. Hey, you it was interesting, and in some of our earlier conversations about the podcast, you sent me some case studies, and I kind of flagged one. I was like, "Ooh, I would love to maybe talk through this on a situation, like just to dig in a little bit." And so I'm reading from my screen here. If you're watching on YouTube, I'm not looking at you. Sorry, because I'm literally reading the story. And so Mrs. Jones, I'm assuming this is hypothetical.
Hypothetical effect was created by Gemini in this case, by the way.
Oh, good. So I'm using AI to talk about AI. That's great. Mrs. Jones, a history teacher, utilizes Sora to create personalized historical simulations for her students. One student received a simulation where they witnessed a fictionalized conversation between Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, as I recall, was the Southern leader, discussing the complexities of slavery. While the simulation is engaging and sparks conversation, it later turns out to be historically inaccurate, containing fabricated details, potentially perpetuating harmful stereotypes. Questions arise from this. Should AI-generated education require sticker fact-checking? How do we ensure historical accuracy? Who's responsible for potential biases and misinformation produced by AI? Like, I mean, there's a lot that's in this. But overall, like even just, you know, your synopsis coming from this, this is an AI-generated story about how AI simulations are questionable. Like, what are we supposed to do with this? How are we supposed to handle this as churches and people in 2024?
Yeah, and I've got to the point now, the way I use AI is much more in conversation. And so, you know, I literally will say, right, let's sit down and have a bit of a discussion like we're doing now in terms of areas. And then I intentionally kick in a much more critical mindset. So I'm being very critical in terms of what I'm hearing and what I'm seeing and what it's telling me. And so part of the process is not just to say, please help me with this, give me an answer. It literally is, let's have a debate about this particular situation. And what about this aspect? And if I thought about it from that particular aspect, what else should I be thinking about? And then when I get the response from the AI, I'm saying, right, well, does that make sense in this particular context? Or is that really just a bit of an outlier? Yes, I guess in that situation that may apply. But for this context, that particular aspect doesn't apply. And so a lot of what I'm doing is really this much more rich interaction with a mindset of being critical. You know, kind of it goes back a little bit to the Bereans in Acts, where essentially they were very careful about testing and keeping on going back and validating and testing that what they were hearing was appropriate, was based on scripture. And in the same way, I'm using that same type of thinking. Is this based on what I know to be true or what I understand to be true? Or is there something that I'm actually seeing now as different? And so that whole application of critical thinking. And so when you start applying that mindset, if I'm going to use an AI to create a story, I've got to recognize that AI is it's a statistical engine. That's what it is. It literally is. It's got been trained by a whole lot of data, and it literally has picked up just like we pick up the relationship between certain things, coffee and hot, you know, those types of examples. We recognize that over time we've seen them occur very together so often that we put those two things together. And so when it's creating a story, or when I'm allowing it to be creative and not limiting it and saying, not be factual, it's then going to create something that is less likely to be factual. And so I've got to be even more careful, even more critical in terms of what is produced and saying, right, is that factual, is that not factual? And in fact, go back and test it. And in some cases, I go back and say, right, now go back on yourself, AI, and validate. Give me some validation that what you've actually produced is factually correct or is not. So if, for instance, in my classes, and I teach at the University of South Florida, in my classes where I use that, I often go back and say, right, here is some information, and I create stories like this around ethical dilemmas. And I then get it to actually test and validate that what is actually put together makes sense and is actually factually based, or it's got some time for foundation. It's not totally fictitious in terms of false, like I said, rather than fictitious, totally false in this concept. And so that really is where we need to start looking at not only ourselves, but also testing it. And then when we get a response back, even validating that, there's clearly it can be just as certain about a falsehood or falseness as it is about a truthfulness. And so even then, when you say, right, test yourself and come back and prove that you're right, show me where you got that content from, or go and look out on the internet and give me some validation of that information, then being very careful that we actually test and apply that critical thinking to it as well. And so in those situations, so when I'm using, and just going back to Sora, when I'm starting to create visual images, and one of the images, for instance, they've got a drone flying down a river in a gold rush town in I think Colorado. You know, in that type of situation, one of the questions I'd be asking is, okay, so is all that information valid? You know, are there, who are the people that would be suspect? Is that correct from a bias perspective, or has it actually used a different bias, an incorrect bias? You know, so those are the types of things that I'd then be even questioning when I started looking at that video being produced by this large language models using the same type of critical thinking.
It's this misleading, it's this falseness, it's the fact checking for truth and the validating. For me anyway, and I consider myself a technologically advanced and savvy and you know, lover of innovator, but you know, a lot of this makes me pause. You know, I'm usually the guy, honestly, that's like the, you know, Life Church Craig Rochelle, anything short of sin we should be doing for the kingdom, and let's do it. And so, like, you know, part of me wants to lean into how, you know, the church can utilize this and take advantage of it. But I ask myself, like, if would Jesus use Sora? Would Paul, in everything aggressive that he's done, would they take advantage of this? Maybe the problem is in its infancy. I don't know, and we need to give it time to fully develop beyond that. But honestly, like, this is causing me to pause a little bit on this technology, and I'm saying this on my podcast, which is, you know, public record for me. And part of me is like, Jeff, take it back. But I really, like, I can't. Like, I really this scares the crap out of me. Like, I don't know, am I off base?
I think we all need to be very, very careful about what we're looking at. Because I think the power and the, as the AI organizations talk about, we see the emerging capabilities that are appearing as it's learning from a bigger and bigger data set and being taught to do different things or being allowed to do different things. The whole process of saying, right, if we take a look at this and think about the potential upsides and downsides, we've got to be able to objectively look at it and say, how can we use it for good? And how can we make sure the way we're using it for good is not going to be misused for bad? So all of us know that we can stand up and we can give a great talk, and then someone's going to cut out a small slice and say, you know, see, Jeff said this, and, you know, wasn't that so bad of him? And, you know, in the context of the whole story, it was, you know, clearly not. And so the whole thing we've got to look at is, this is certainly a positive tool that can be used in a positive way. Yeah. But then we've got to be aware that it can be misused as well. And even in our use in a good way, it can be taken and it can be misused. And so part of it is being very circumspect in terms of how do we use it and how quickly we lean into it. At the same time, I'd say, if we're not moving into it quickly and experimenting with it, within appropriate guardrails and in appropriate closed spaces, I think we'll be losing out. And so part of it is testing and validating and with wise counsel to say, right, how do we use it and how do we take advantage of it? But realistically, if I just sit back and say, you know, I'm sitting next to the sea and Jesus is giving his talk about the, you know, the parable of the sower. He was looking around, I presume, and saying, oh, there's some grass, you know, passing the grass or onto the stones, you know, and it was visual. It was, people could see right there and they could immediately experience it. If I could do the same thing with Sora, would that not also be an advantage if that's going to help people to actually understand what Jesus was saying more effectively? So I think, you know, there's that part of it. But then immediately the guardrails come in and say, right, so what can be misinterpreted? You know, what can be embedded in there that could bias things? Oh, you'd have the wrong type of people there, or, you know, or maybe he'll be using the wrong language or the wrong accent. And so all the biases may start coming in and saying, well, you know, that's not really what Jesus was saying because it was said in the wrong tone. You know, and all those things start coming into play, and we then got to step back and say, right, so how do we take advantage of this in a way that's going to be beneficial without getting ourselves too tightly caught up in saying, well, we don't want to use it because there are so many potential downsides. I lean towards, I'd rather use it, be very careful, but I'd rather use it and take advantage of the technology more extensively for the benefit of all, for the growth of all, and then make sure that we've got the appropriate controls around it versus saying, no, let's hold back just in case this might be bad. So, you know, I'm perhaps lean towards let's use it. Be careful how we use it. Be circumspect, but use it and lean forward into it.
It's interesting. I'm gonna put you on the spot here a little bit. We're gonna shift from ethics and probably a little more towards opinion, which is interesting where you're going. Like examples from let's even go practical here. Like what? So Sora gets out of red, the red team, and is opened up at some level. It's a $29.95 month feature set to get this, and you can, anybody can now, within whatever confines, whatever filters, whatever, anybody can create a text to video. Like, what are some examples of how the church should experiment, utilize tests? Like, do you have any ideas pop to mind or opinions on maybe some early testing grounds for how the church could use this practically?
I think the areas that I'd be looking at is how do we create the environment that is friendly and beautiful and accepting. So the first place I'd be looking at is much more, how do I create an environment where people come into and it's clearly beautiful. And I'd be looking at natural beauty here, in terms of mountains and valleys and rivers and so on, and all the things that naturally move us towards a peacefulness. So, thinking about Psalm 23, he leads me beside quiet waters, and those are the types of things that I'd say, right, is this a way of us creating an environment that's going to help people come in, be peaceful, and therefore open themselves up more to God and to be, to be in a place where to meet God in those situations. So that's one place I'd start first. The other places I think would be when we start saying, right, how can we emphasize things without moving people, nudging people incorrectly? And so this goes back to my whole fear of something visual is much more powerful than something that's just sound or read. And so how can I use it in a good way to be able to show a principle or show a series of images that would just reinforce the thought without overdriving it towards biasing and nudging in the wrong direction. And so I think there are ways of just enriching our environment of how do we depict biblical stories, how do we bring those to life. And a lot of that would be around, many of us, and I've certainly helped when I've gone into videos of Israel at a particular time. This is what it would be like. And just helping to understand the context of the Bible story, like we're just talking about Jesus, talking about this, the sower, and standing on the boat and being, talking into the valley, talking to the people across on the mountainside. And just the picture and understanding what that looked like and what that sounded like and what else was happening around there, I think that enriches the experience and enriches the understanding. And so I would move there, but again, this is where we've got to be fairly, fairly careful and fairly guarded in what we're doing. And I think something like the Chosen have looked at that and have been very careful in terms of what they were doing in terms of depicting Jesus and depicting the New Testament, the world. And I think those types of boundaries we need to look at, but enriching that and helping people understand it without replacing the Bible, without replacing, creating a new something that people believe in, but really always using it to reinforce scripture, reinforce the foundations that we have. So that's where I certainly would look into it.
Well, we've been talking a lot about Sora, text to chat, or just you text to video, generative AI, ChatGPT, like it's all in that Gen AI space, which seems to be exploding quickly. I mean, you got your studies 22, and it was all over the place. Yeah. What fall? No, it started what, November 22, right? Didn't it?
Yeah. I started studying in 2020, so just prior to that, but yeah.
Are there, and so let's, I've asked this question because, at some point, Gen AI is not going to be the only AI category we're looking at, and there will be others, other aspects of artificial intelligence we're going to be diving into. Are there other aspects right now we should be aware of? What's next? What are we doing? You know, all this content is nice, but there's much more to AI than just the content piece. What else should we be concerned about or looking at ethically concerning AI?
So certainly the big shiny object right now is large language models, generative AI, and everything associated with that. But if you look on the periphery of that, we see a crossover into a number of areas. So, for instance, things like digital twins, where essentially I create a digital image of a physical object. I'm able to actually do something in a digital space and then replicate that in the physical space. And that's very powerful, for instance, where I'm looking at an airplane engine and I've got a digital version of the airplane engine and I can manage it. And so those types of things are happening, but you can very quickly say, right, so, hey, let's do a digital twin of a human, you know, and start actually looking at, okay, so how do we sense the skin, or how do we actually start getting inside the mind? So that's the one area. So digital twinning, very powerful in terms of where it is in manufacturing, but then of course when you start seeing human digital twins, we start then getting to a different space. I think the other aspect that we've seen happening is the whole, not just generative AI, but adaptive AI. So generative AI is really focused on, I've learned stuff I'm going to replicate, and based on my learning, I'm going to give you an example. So essentially I'm continuing based on my learning. Adaptive AI starts moving towards saying, right, how do I create something new that is not necessarily based on anything I've learned, but let me extend what I've learned and look in new spaces. So adaptive AI then becomes something that is a new space. And when you start putting those together, generative AI, adaptive AI together, you can imagine where things then become fairly complex. And so that's relatively new. We're starting to see some organizations focusing in that space. And then the other, you know, everything we do becoming essentially AI embedded. You know, so whether it's the metaverse environment, whether it's the gaming environment, and all of those becoming richer and richer and enhanced by the AI and the generative AI and the various AI models. I think we've certainly seen that. And you know, the other part is in AI, you've got essentially large language models which are self-learning, if you wish, or reinforcement learning. And then there is the other one, which is supervised learning. So if you think of, for instance, a Watson type of environment where I've given it information, said, here's a lot of information. This is a particular piece of information, and this is how it's labeled. And so there's that side, which is supervised learning. We've got the unsupervised or reinforcement learning. And when you start putting those two together, they actually become quite a powerful combination in terms of the generative AI being able to ask kind of unrelated questions against a factual base, and then being able to essentially have this combination of playing off one or another from a supervised learning and unsupervised learning component. So those are the types of things. But I would say that the space of growth around generative AI is only going to get larger. So the more and more information that it's fed, the more modes that it's fed it in, so video and audio, etc., the more of those modes it plays in, the fact that it's moving, and we've of course seen it now, the whole robot side of things, Optimus, etc., where essentially you've got the large language model or the ability, the digital brain built into a robot, and now you have the robot having a couple more of the sensors, so the feel, the ability to move, and so that being then added to it. Which is then going to be moving from just a textual and a video thing to, you know, a physical device, and a much more human type device.
Okay, are you literally saying that there's Optimus is putting AI into a robot like that? That's a project.
So if you look at what
like Optimus Prime Transformers, like I'm geeking out over here.
No. This is Tesla Optimus. So essentially, their robot. So essentially, the large language model capability is being used as a foundation. So if you look at a lot of the earlier robots were trained on, here was a program, a programmatic thing. So do the step one, step two, step three, step four. The current robots are using the same large language model approach, which is, all I want you to do is go and figure out how to make a cup of coffee. There's the house. See you later. Go and figure it out. And literally through its ability to perceive and learn and understand, it knows that it needs to make coffee. So it's going to look for a coffee machine. It's going to look for coffee beans. It's going to look for milk, etc., and actually create that, make that cup of coffee. And it's going to learn. So it's not trained step by step. So to make a cup of coffee, you go through this door, you go there, you open up that fridge. It literally goes through a process of perceiving and using a large language model to then try and figure out what it needs to do to create a cup of coffee. And that is what is embedded in the, for instance, the Tesla Optimus, and there are a couple of others that are now starting to have that large language model capability. So it literally is, you know, make a cup of coffee or walk into a room, what should you do? And the first thing it does, oh, it's untidy, let me tidy the room. Or, hey, there's a fire in the corner, I'm going to try and put the fire out. You know, so that whole process of not predetermining it, the steps it's going to use, but actually having the essentially the digital brain being able to understand the environment, interpret the environment, and take appropriate responses.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I mean, so much. Honestly, I could sit here for another hour and just dig in to what people are working on or what is, honestly, 6 months to a year away. I mean, because this thing is tracking so fast that it's like, oh my gosh, it's a decade before. No, forget that. It's going to be tomorrow. Before we're going to have to address and deal with all this. It's interesting. We had Aaron Siniff. He's the chief technical officer for PushPay. I don't know if you're familiar with PushPay. It's a billion-dollar Christian tech company. It was acquired for $950 million, I don't know, maybe 6 months, maybe a year ago. But and so he was on the podcast and was talking about some things, and I asked him about AI and his stance on AI. We just published that podcast maybe a couple weeks ago. But he said it was really interesting. He's like, Jeff, as a church, he's like, you're either using AI or you don't realize you're using AI, but AI is already baked into everything. It's already, you know, you can say you hate it and you're afraid of it, but you're already using it at some level. And, you know, even Siri interrupting this podcast earlier is a perfect example of, you know, AI being AI. You know, whether we want it or not, it's lurking, paying attention and waiting to step in as it seems helpful. You know, I say to my daughter, hey, sweetie, all the time. And Siri always chimes back, what can I do for you? And I'm like, I'm not talking to you, Siri. I'm talking to my daughter. And so that's, you know, yet another interruption. But it's the reality of where we are, right? And so it's, as a church, I think it's understanding the implications, recognizing the people that are drawing the lines, which I love that there are multiple people, and then it's managing ourselves on how we're using that situation and protecting our legacies where we have to make sure that we're self-guarded and that we're not putting ourselves in harm's way for those that might take advantage of it, because somebody will. I mean, to think that everybody's going to control their own garden and manage their own space, like, it's 2024. Nobody's going to, like, that's, we can't expect everybody else to play nice. We've got to protect ourselves. But at the same time, we can't bury our head in the sand and like, as much as I want to with this and think that everybody's, that it doesn't exist, because the reality is it does. So listen, Quentin, this has been incredible. Like, I almost want to bring it back and talk more about the robotic aspect of this, but let's wait for that to become a little more mainstream or potentially mainstream before we do that. So as we're wrapping up and landing the plane here, man, any closing thoughts on your side?
No, I think really, as you know, I go back to one of my fundamental focus areas where I'm focused on ethics and recognizing ethics got two sides. And really, how do we keep on driving towards the positive aspect? There's just so much noise out there of just doomsday and how bad it can be. And I really believe that as Christians, we can be taking advantage of this and saying, hey, there's a huge positive bend, and driving it and not being blind to it and really forcing the big tech companies into the right direction, but really bringing the Christian voice and the positive voice and the human flourishing voice, the shalom voice into the play, and really driving it towards that direction. and just recognize that, you know, there are risks, but at the same time, there are huge advantages as well. And those are the ones in my mind that we should be focusing on and really using for kingdom. And use for the kingdom's sake, for sure.
Well, for a guy that's job is literally risk assessment, or his studies has been risk assessment of artificial intelligence, I feel that the risks have been assessed. And part of me is a little surprised that you're, you know, pro on that. I was actually expecting a little more anti, honestly, just, you know, hindsight being what it was, I was expecting a little more challenge from that, but I feel challenged. And so it's like, all right, let's figure out how to, you know, walk before we run here. And, you know, I tell people all the time, trust but verify. And so I have a feeling, you know, with Sora and moving forward in other spaces, it's going to be a lot of that trust but verify moving forward, and, you know, declare, label, confess is not the right word. That's negative connotation, but that, at least moving forward with that. So I think this is going to be, it'll make for an interesting season moving forward. But hey, we're going to land the plane. Thank you, Quentin. Quentin McGrath, thank you very much for jumping here on the podcast and sharing. Anytime I want to talk AI ethics, you're an email away, so I appreciate that. But we're going to land the plane. So for Quentin, this is Jeff with The Church Digital. Thanks for jumping on the podcast. We'll see you next time on the show. Y'all have a good day.